Good evening. Our last class on the Lankavatara Sutra for the time being. There's a lot more sutra we didn't talk about, so this could be an endless topic of study. But for now, we finish up with the sections on Tathagatagarbha. We started last week talking about Buddha nature. The heart of the Tathagata. The that inner truth of the Buddha. So this is section 28, page 109. Just to review a little from this last section, this kind of defining Tathagatagarbha here. Mahamati Bodhisattva then asked the Buddha, "In the sutras, the Bhagavan has said that the Tathagatagarbha is intrinsically pure, endowed with the 32 attributes, and present in the bodies of all beings." So there's the classic list of the 32 like physical marks or characteristics of the Buddha, like long earlobes and swastikas on the chest and wheel marks on the hands and so on. But there's also a list of, particularly in Buddha nature teachings, of 32 non-physical marks of the Buddha. And that includes things like great compassion and skillful means and wisdom, and so on. So this Buddha nature, or Tathagatagarbha, intrinsically pure, meaning like by its very nature, pure from all delusion and self-centered thought, and endowed with all these characteristics of Buddha's mind, like compassion and wisdom and skillful means, is present in the bodies of all beings. I don't think this necessarily means our physical body, but we could say it pervades our physical body and it manifests as our physical body. And that, like a priceless jewel wrapped in soiled clothing, the ever-present, unchanging Tathagatagarbha is likewise wrapped in the soiled clothing of the skandhas, dhatus, and ayatanas, and stained with the stain of the erroneous projections of greed, anger, and delusion. And this is what all Buddhas teach. So this Buddha nature is wrapped in the skandhas, dhatus, ayatanas. It's wrapped in all the things we think we are, like the body, the feelings, the conceptual thoughts, the karmic tendencies, and even dualistic consciousness. That's like the all of that is the so-called soiled clothing that wraps up this pure Buddha nature. How is it that what the Bhagavan says about the Tathagatagarbha is the same as what followers of other paths say about a self, an Atman? So then the Buddha goes on to say that it's not the same. It sounds very similar to an Atman, which is a essential, core, unchanging self that travels from life to life. And it also is kind of like who we truly are. But the difference is that an Atman, self as Atman, doesn't mean like an ego self. It means like a core, true nature. But it's like, as I understand this early pre-Buddhist teachings, an Atman's like a kind of an entity or like an essence. And it inherently exists in some way, almost like we could say a thing, not a physical thing, but but an entity called a self. Whereas Tathagatagarbha is not an entity, it's not a thing, it doesn't inherently exist as a kind of an essence, which is like a, you know, truly existent, indestructible thing. But it's very close, because it's unchanging and ever-present. Yes?
Also, with Atman would be unchanging, right?
Yeah.
With Tathagatagarbha would be changing.
Well, it says here that Tathagatagarbha is the it says the unchanging Tathagatagarbha. So actually, it's Tathagatagarbha in a way it's defined as permanence. It's because to be changing, to be coming and going, that's the realm of the phenomena world, and this Tathagatagarbha is not a thing that comes and goes. It's actually emptiness, and emptiness doesn't come and go. The way everything is free of characteristics and free of what we think it is, that way that it's free doesn't come and go. So therefore, emptiness is unchanging.
Can we say that Atman is personal and Tathagatagarbha is non-personal?
Maybe that. But in these Vedic teachings of the Atman, what is it like? There's like an individual ego self that is kind of transcended to realize the Atman. And I don't know the details of these pre-Buddhist teachings, how if they see that Atman as more universal or individual. But I do understand it to be a little bit more like individual. In fact, some schools would even talk about it like it has this subtle, not exactly physical, but some subtle kind of essence that actually has a certain size that resides in the heart.
Individuality.
Yeah, in the heart of each person, like the heart organ of each person and sentient being. So that sounds a little different, because the Tathagatagarbha has no location. And we can't really say that it's individual, and yet it pervades individual beings. So that might be one distinction, individual versus like universal. But the Buddha replies here, that the way he's going to say that it's not a self, is he says, the Tathagatagarbha of which I speak is not the same as this self, or this essence or entity, the Atman, mentioned by followers of other paths. Mahamati, when I speak about the Tathagatagarbha, sometimes I call it emptiness. They never call it self, emptiness. I call it formlessness or intentionlessness, or the realm of reality, Dharma nature, the Dharma body, or Nirvana, or what is devoid of self-existence. That sounds pretty different than a self. What's devoid of self-existence? Nisvabhavata, or what neither arises nor ceases, or original quiescence, or intrinsic nirvana, or similar expressions. And then he says, it's to put an end to the fear that foolish beings have about the expression no self, that the Tathagatas, the Arhats, the fully enlightened ones, proclaim the teaching of the Tathagatagarbha as this projectionless realm devoid of fabrications. So here he's saying, in this sutra he's saying, this Tathagatagarbha teaching is kind of like a skillful means for people who are afraid of opening to no self. They feel like that's too groundless, will just disappear into nothingness. Saying, don't worry, there's this pure Buddha nature that will be your resting ground. That doesn't sound so scary, does it? Sentient beings? That doesn't sound so scary as there is no abiding self. Which might not sound so scary to us, but I think if we really get closer and closer to the very core being who we think we are, being groundless and not there, it might be quite frightening. But Buddha nature, the Tathagatagarbha, as a skillful teaching, offers a kind of like something positive something that's not just a negation. So here it's like he's saying that's a skillful means, but I find it interesting that later in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, another essential Buddha nature teaching sutra, there he says, he switches it. He says, Buddha nature is like the true teaching, and as skillful means, I taught no self. You know, and now I'm revealing the true teaching in this sutra called Buddha nature, that's this permanent, unchanging, blissful awareness. And people weren't ready for that, so I taught, in the early teachings I taught, there's no self, it's just so they wouldn't cling to anything. So that's just another side. So which is the true teaching and which is the skillful means? No self or Tathagata Garbha? And I think we could say that it's skillful means to talk about them either way. You know, depending on which sutra, it's we don't have to say this is the true one and this is the skillful means. It's all just language. Anything you say in words is just skillful means anyway. And to combine them, those two, as the ultimate truth, selflessness and Tathagata Garbha, is done in this section of the sutra, where the Buddha uses the term later down at the bottom, the Tathagata Nairatmiya Garbha, which means that he kind of like interfuses the two terms. Nairatmiya is another word for anatman. It means no self or selflessness. So the Tathagata selfless Garbha, the Tathagata no self storehouse, the Tathagata selfless heart. So I think that's really beautiful, that it's like combined into, neither one is like just provisional skillful teaching, and neither one is like the ultimate teaching. It's like they're both completely, I could say they're both the ultimate teaching of all Buddhas. So, Mahamati Bodhisattvas of the present and future should not become attached to any view of self. And so this is where we got to last week. Take, for example, a potter who applies such things as manual labor, water, a stick, a wheel, and a string to a lump of clay to make different kinds of vessels. This is like a metaphor for skillful means, like making a pot out of clay. The Tathagata is also like this, applying wisdom and a variety of skillful means to what has no self and is free from projection. So maybe we could see this metaphor as like the lump of clay is like selflessness, but you can mold it, this lump of clay, into something like a beautiful, shining Tathagata Garbha, Buddha wisdom pot. Nice and round and symmetrical and indestructible. But it's really just a way of talking about this formless lump of clay. It's kind of a funny metaphor, but I think that's what it's pointing to.
When I was in January, we studied the Sangha's book, and we were talking about the transformation of the mind through practice, and the kind of migration from a Nirmanakaya type thing to a Dhammakaya type thing. And it's like Tathagata Garbha is a way of speaking of the direction of the practice, so long as one is sentient and embodied, that a Buddha, therefore, is fully transformed. Actually, Tathagata Garbha is not any longer even considered.
No, we talked about this last week too, that the classical way of talking about it is that all sentient beings' true nature is Tathagata Garbha, or Buddha nature, and that term means like before it's fully revealed as a fully enlightened Buddha, or before the obscurations to the Tathagata to Buddhahood are removed. It's called Buddha nature. So we say that Buddhas, in a way, Buddhas have Buddha nature. Or Buddha's true nature is also Buddha nature, of course, right? By using the term Tathagatagarbha, or Buddha nature, refers to sentient beings' true nature. And then when the obscurations, which is like the beliefs that make us think that this is not Buddha nature, and all other conceptual ideas are dropped away, then the Tathagatagarbha is then called the Dharmakaya of the Buddha, the Buddha's true Dharma body. So you could say, like, Tathagatagarbha, when it's in the form of a sentient being, is called a sentient being with Buddha nature. And Tathagatagarbha, when the sentient being is fully let go of, then it's called the Buddha's Dharma body. I think the really essential point here with the Buddha nature that is worth saying again is that the Buddha nature is exactly the same in a sentient being and in a fully enlightened Buddha. That it doesn't have to be improved.
Dynamic quality of coming. Talk of that which comes. What's the translation of that?
Oh, the thus come one.
Thus come one. So the sense of manifesting sentience is the key difference, isn't it?
Well, the Tathagata is not a sentient being, strictly speaking, and he's called the thus come one. I think it means coming and going from and to thusness, which is not really coming and going. The pure Dharmakaya neither appears nor disappears. And yet, that's just a little, way that the Buddha referred to himself as coming from thusness, or coming as thusness, which is maybe like a little play on the two truths. Thusness is ultimate truth.
Well,
I don't know if we call the Buddha of coming to delusion, though. The Tathagata, as the fully enlightened Buddha, really doesn't come and go, and doesn't. The Buddha can meet deluded beings. But the Buddha is totally free from delusion. But sentient beings, Tathagatagarbha, like this heart of the Tathagata, of the non-deluded one, can manifest as a deluded being. So sometimes it's called just, instead of Tathagata, I think Tathagata is just referring to one of the names of the Buddha. Sometimes it's called Sugata Garbha or Buddha Garbha. So, sometimes I speak about the Tathagatagarbha, and sometimes I speak of no self. Thus, the Tathagatagarbha of which I speak is not the same with the self spoken of by followers of other paths. This is what's meant by the teaching of the Tathagatagarbha. The Tathagatagarbha is taught to attract those members of other paths who are attached to a self, so that they will give up their projection of an unreal self, and will enter the threefold gate of liberation, which is emptiness, formlessness, and intentionlessness, which we saw up above are other names for Buddha nature, and aspire to attain unexcelled complete enlightenment forthwith. So for people in India in Buddha's time who were attached to the idea of an Atman, he taught this Tathagatagarbha because it's a very similar idea. And then when we'll go with Tathagatagarbha. He says, by the way, Tathagatagarbha has no fixed self, no abiding self. He kind of lures in the Atman believers and then says, actually, Tathagatagarbha is Anatman, or Nairatya. This is why the Tathagatas, the Arhats, the fully enlightened ones, speak in this manner about the Tathagatagarbha. To speak otherwise would be to agree with the followers of other paths. So it's really getting into this like sectarian kind of like other view thing. Clarifying the view of Tathagatagarbha is the main point here. Therefore, Mahamati, in order to avoid the views of followers of other paths, you should rely on the selfless Tathagatagarbha, the Tathagata Nairatmiya Garbha. Or you should accept and take up and rely on the selfless Tathagatagarbha. So that's the practice instruction. Accept Buddha nature, take it up and rely on Buddha nature. So now we go to the next section of LXXII, 82, page 240 in Red Pine. So this is the other main section in the sutra on Tathagatagarbha. And now he's going to make the link between Tathagatagarbha, Buddha nature, and Alaya Vijnana. So this is unique to this sutra to basically equate these or look at the non-duality of Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness, which we've talked about a lot before, the storehouse of delusion, the storehouse of dualistic thinking, of karmic tendencies. That's what the Alaya Vijnana is. It's by nature, it's distorted. And that's how the Alaya Vijnana is usually taught in sutras prior to this, and that the Alaya Vijnana, because it's the basic storehouse of delusion, it has to be transformed or overturned or dropped away, revealed to be Tathagatagarbha. That's the transformation of the basis, is this basically ending of Alaya Vijnana, because it's just a bunch of delusion. And then Tathagatagarbha, Buddha nature, is fully unobstructed. We could say this is the earlier view, that Alaya Vijnana is the obstruction to Buddha nature. It is that soiled clothing of the skandhas and so on. Another name for that would be the Alaya Vijnana. Everything in our dualistic experience all day long is like emerging forth from the storehouse consciousness. Now there is, in this earlier model, like Asanga talks about these pure Buddha nature seeds. He doesn't use the word Buddha nature, but like kind of Buddha wisdom seeds that are some of the seeds planted in the storehouse of delusion. It's a field of delusion, but there's a few of these like non-dual wisdom seeds that are planted in there, and that was maybe like an early view of Buddha nature, saying that there's like Buddha nature seeds, and when they're watered by understanding of Buddha nature, that like makes them kind of sprout as seeds and start manifesting as Buddha nature, and eventually they take over the whole field, and all those weeds in the storehouse are like buried in the Buddha sprouts. So that's kind of an earlier view, and kind of like you can see how it's quite separate. That, or in a way, in that view, it's like there's the storehouse with little bits of Buddha nature in it. Now I would propose here, looking at like almost like an opposite kind of metaphor. These are all just metaphors for like trying to understand how this is being taught. That Buddha nature is like the ocean, endless ocean, with no boundaries and perfectly pure water with nothing in it at all. Clear, shining, boundless ocean. It's kind of nice because the ocean's not nothing, right? It's not like empty space. It's like something called water, but like perfectly pure water. And then in that water of Buddha nature is one metaphor we could use is like little tiny particles of silt or sediment. And those particles we could call Alaya Vijnana. So rather than this big ocean storehouse called Alaya with particles of Buddha nature in it, what if we look at it as the ocean of Buddha nature with particles of dualistic thought in it? Almost like those are like the seed, they talk about the seeds in Alaya. What if the seeds are actually in this ocean of Buddha nature? But they're completely mixed in with it. So the particles are not, you don't just see particles floating, like in, because there's a lot of them, right? there's tons of particles, so that it just looks like a completely opaque brown ocean, totally muddy, and you can't even see the particles. They're so small and subtle, but those delusion particles like color the whole ocean of Buddha nature, opaque and muddy looking. And then the practice, you could say, is settling the ocean, letting all the waves get still, and letting all that sediment slowly settle to the bottom. So then the ocean, all those particles are now just resting on the bottom, basically gone from the ocean. They're not mixed in with it. And that's when we say that the ocean of Tathagatagarbha is free from all the dualistic obscurations of particles. And now it's called the Dharmakaya. Now it's called the ocean of the completely realized Buddha with no obstructions. So I think that metaphor, for me, that's one that works just as we start to now go into this territory of the relationship between Alaya and Tathagatagarbha. It almost sounds like, in this sutra, like they're exactly the same thing, but are they really exactly the same? Because we actually talk about Alaya and Tathagatagarbha. I mean, we'll see as we read this. But maybe just keep in mind this metaphor is, when it's like a muddy ocean, they seem like they're exactly the same, right? They're completely interfused. The particles of silt and the pure water are like separable. And that's like our life. It's like this muddy water. It's actually totally pure water, but it's completely interfused with our dualistic conceptual thought that's the cause of all our troubles. But it's possible to actually like separate them. And so now part of the thing too is, we could say, that's where this metaphor starts to break down. We say, well, where did these particles come from? Because it looks like in this sutra they're saying the particles of silt actually are a kind of manifestation of the Buddha nature. So we don't say that silt is a manifestation of water, so we might try to think of some other metaphor. Yeah.
I was just thinking that as you were speaking, mm-hmm. and I was thinking, well, maybe just turbulence in the water would be it feels like it could go further because it can just settle out.
Ah, that's pretty good. Yeah, it's even more non-dual to say it's a turbulence is exactly the same as water, but it can't be seen as in its purity. It seems like something else is happening. Yeah, another one I thought of is classic metaphor is ice and water. Like Hakuin talks about that, referring I think to Buddha nature. That sentient beings are like ice. Buddha nature is like water. And so exactly the same nature, you know, ice is not chemically different from water in the slightest, but it seems to be different, right? It's like so we could again picture like the ocean of Buddha nature with big chunks of ice floating in it. Icebergs, yeah. And like we're icebergs. We're like frozen Buddha nature. The nice thing about the ice metaphor too is it's kind of like a sentient being, an iceberg sentient being is kind of like a constriction of free-flowing Buddha nature.
What's considered a constriction?
And ice is like it's frozen, right? It can't move. It's a fixation. It can't move and respond freely and skillfully. It's like stuck in this like solid, fixed form. Like if you could choose to be an ocean or an iceberg, you might choose to be an ocean. I think that metaphor works like turbulence. Ice works kind of nicely. Maybe too.
I made this
mm-hmm.
book. I believe it's the same thing we're talking about. In here it's called quiescent abandonment. And how then should we understand the excellence of quiescent abandonment? And it says, the destruction of defilement, which is kind of double negative, the destruction of defilement by bodhisattvas is their non-abiding cessation. which is kind of a purification of the alaya vijnana.
I think that sounds right. We just have to be really clear on what the destruction is. And again, going back to the snake and rope metaphor. Yeah, but what do we, it's, the word destruction is a kind of loaded term. It sounds like we have to actually crush and destroy something. Whereas when you look at the snake and the rope, do you have to destroy the snake? No, you just have to look and see that it's actually not a snake.
Well, it's any delusions, right?
Yeah, I'm bringing up the problem with the term destruction rather than just revelation.
So it says that you're in transmigration, which I think is this transformation. Transmigration refers to the defiled aspect of the other dependent pattern. Cessation refers to the purified aspect of the other dependent.
I think transmigration there would mean like the cyclic cycle of samsara. Transmigration from life to life based on delusion.
Making ice, making waves.
Yeah.
The basic support refers to both these aspects, purified and defined. The basic support. So, in this case, Tathagatagarbha and Dharmakaya can be interchangeable under different conditions.
I mean, I hear that as, I don't know if we want to get too into this other text, right, but I hear that as the basic support is like the other dependent character, or which we can kind of equate with alaya vijnana, is the support for deluded transmigration, and it's the support for liberation, because it also is the Tathagatagarbha. So I think that's true. You could relate that phrase with this, what we're talking about, that the alaya vijnana is the support for delusion and it's the support for enlightenment. Because it's actually a manifestation of Buddha nature. You could say, and I think this type of thing is why this sutra became one of the foundational teachings of the Zen school, to say that like when we look at our delusion, instead of seeing it as this like horrible thing we have to get rid of, we look carefully and we see that the true nature of our delusion is actually Buddha nature. Which is another way of, in this sutra we'd be saying our delusion is called the storehouse consciousness. That's what gives rise to all our delusion. But what is that storehouse consciousness? It's just turbulence in the ocean, or it's just a frozen piece of ocean. But it's the very nature of the ocean. And it's just, the practice is just to melt the iceberg through Buddha's warmth. accept and rely on the selfless Tathagatagarbha. Now we're on page 240. Mahamati once more asked the Buddha, Bhagavan, would you please explain again the arising and cessation of the skandhas, dhatus, and ayatanas? This is like all the conditioned stuff that we think we are. How does all that stuff arise and cease? If they contain no self, who arises and who ceases? Foolish people rely on arising and cessation and fail to experience an end of suffering and fail to know nirvana. So without getting too into this, I think the point here is that who's behind all this arising and ceasing if it's not a self? And then the Buddha's going to start saying, well, actually, we can say that there's somebody behind all this arising and ceasing, but we're not going to say it's a self, we're going to say it's Tathagatagarbha. Now we're getting into the relationship of this pure Tathagatagarbha. Is the basis for all this arising and ceasing stuff we call body, mind, feelings, karmic tendencies. So the Buddha says, excellent, listen carefully and I will tell you. May we be so instructed, Mahamati said. And the Buddha said, the Tathagatagarbha is the cause of whatever is good and bad and is responsible for every form of existence everywhere. So that's this huge leap into a different kind of way of talking about Tathagatagarbha. It's no longer just this permanent, pure, shining, non-dual awareness. It's actually the cause, right? It's the cause of whatever is good and bad. It's the cause of dualistic stuff. And it's responsible for every form of existence everywhere. So the Tathagatagarbha, this pure non-dual awareness, causes all this like illusory display of a separate world. Amazing.
So Michael Kant is called the condition of possibility.
Yeah. The condition of possibility?
Condition of possibility if anything can exist.
Yeah. And it's also, you know, it's we could say it has these different functions. One function is to just like shine and radiate as like pure non-dual awareness, like it does in a Buddha. And then it also has this function that it can manifest as sentient beings and illusions. And even though in a Buddha it doesn't do that anymore, in the Buddha it doesn't give rise to good and bad and forms of existence which don't really exist. But in sentient beings it can do that. And so I think this is, again, a wonderful non-dual way of looking at this pure Buddha nature makes us. And everything, all our confusion about it and everything, is all like pieces of Buddha nature. It's all manifestations of Buddha nature. The ice is just a manifestation of the water, or the turbulence is just a manifestation of the water. It's no different. It's the very nature of delusion is Buddha nature. But Buddha nature can give rise to a sentient being with all their delusions. It's like an actor, it being Tathagatagarbha. It's like an actor who changes appearances in different settings, but who lacks a self or what belongs to a self. Because this is not understood, followers of other paths unwittingly imagine an agent responsible for the effects that arise from the threefold combination of sensory power, domain, and consciousness. This is like how effects arise from like an eye organ. Domain in this case would be like the color. Domain's a kind of funny word, but the object. Say like the sense power, the object, and the consciousness. The three of them come together and create a sensory experience. Or for a mental experience, like the concept of the Zendo, that's the mind organ, the Dharma of Zendo and the mind consciousness come together. So we see that those three come together, and that's one of the Buddha's teachings of no self, is like how the mind can create reality without a self behind it, just by like the mind, objects, and the sense organs, the sense consciousnesses, and the sense objects come together, and we have a sensory experience. But there's no self that does that. But we imagine, it says, followers of other paths, but I would propose that we, also followers of the Buddhist path, feel as if there's some self behind this that's making it happen, some agent responsible for this, that's like me, because it's my visual perception. When I see my hand, there's an eye, a color, and a consciousness coming together, but I also feel as if there's me involved here. It's my perception of the hand. So that's the agent responsible. And I'm in charge of looking at the hand now. I created this perception. So we think this, and followers of other paths also think this. But there is no agent called a self, but we could say a so-called agent for this experience is Tathagatagarbha. That actually, like, Buddha nature is giving rise to this dualistic appearance of me looking at a hand over here. The feeling of me looking at a hand doesn't really have a me. But the whole thing is just an appearance of pure Buddha nature manifesting as dualistic appearance. Yeah.
I'm confused.
Mm-hmm.
basically the ocean is the womb of all Buddhas?
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't put an equal sign. Sometimes this sutra sounds like it's doing that, but that's why ice and water is a nice one. Do we say ice equals water? No, they're two different things, but their nature is the same. And ice is a manifestation of water, but it doesn't exactly equal. Equal means like there's no difference at all, right? But the difference is quite subtle. Yeah, the nature of ice is water, right? So, almost equal, right? They are, in a way, almost equal. Yes?
You said that our experience and the ultimate reality and our experience, they're simultaneous. Is that wrong to say that? They occur simultaneously.
Yeah, our kind of dualistic experience of like me being in a room is simultaneous with non-dual reality, simultaneous, and also it's a manifestation of non-dual reality. That's partly why it is simultaneous. So we could say, yeah, that there's an unseen ultimate reality where there's no sense that you're over there and I'm over here, and at the same time there is the sense that you're over there and I'm over here. Those are simultaneous. But also, there's this interesting relationship. I mean, that sense of you being over there is a manifestation of this non-dual reality.
So we can't help experience.
We can't. I mean, for some, we could say, well, why does it do that? Why would non-dual reality create this illusion? And we have no idea why. but it's like the play of the universe or something. It just does this so that we can like discuss these sutras and be awed about them.
Last week I thought of this and I postponed it, but now it just came up again, so I've got to put this out. Last week I was thinking we were talking about algebra. Algebra is about the relationships of constants and variables and the constellations of different variables that can, nevertheless, are interdependent and can be equated in some way. And all of that depends upon the positing of zero. You cannot do that without zero. And yet zero never appears in the relationships. But you can't do it without zero. And so it's like, I thought, yeah, maybe to talk to Garbha, maybe emptiness, all this, is the zero that makes possible the manifestation of all the interdependence and all of the relations.
Yeah, I think we could say that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they all come from zero, or based on zero, depend upon zero.
And then you can't really say what zero is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We've also looked at that, and maybe it's a Zen term about Zenki, the total dynamic functioning, that is sort of the way of the universe, the causes and conditions that of the universe that's not personal, and yet when the causes of condition, but when the causes and conditions of the universe manifests, you know, like this, you know, this particular moment in time makes it very personal. And so that has the element of, you know, in the universal sense, this is clear and pure and all of those ever-present, unchanging. And it can also be, like down at the bottom of the page, the cause of whatever is good, good or bad.
It can come and go.
Duality.
Yep.
And is that a similar...
Also in Zen they talk about essence and function, which is related to the total dynamic function is like the function based on the essence. Or and Dogen talks about Zazen as the essential function of all Buddhas and the functional essence of all ancestors. So it's like this relationship of function and essence, and we could say essence, or like the unchanging source, gives rise to the function, and the function, you know, functions in and through the essence, and they're non-dual. So yeah, the total dynamic working is like the way that, yeah, the way the Buddha nature plays out through causes and conditions. It's like from the point of view of the essence, there actually aren't causes and conditions, and nothing comes and goes, or nothing depends on anything else because there's no things. But yet, that manifests as the appearance of causes and conditions and arising and ceasing and so on. You could also say that that's like the union of the two truths. Function and essence is like, essence is like the ultimate truth where there's no coming and going and it's totally permanent. And then the conventional truth is impermanence of everything, and it's coming and going and it's arising and ceasing dependent on conditions and the whole universe as we know it, and us and sentient beings are like the conventional truth. But they're both truths, and they're united in this way. So I think we can also look at Tathagatagarbha, we could see as like this ultimate truth, it's permanent, and Alayavijnana is its conventional aspect. And the union of the two truths is called Alayavijnana Tathagatagarbha. That's it, I think, how we could look at it too. And it's not like the conventional truth is less valuable or something than the ultimate truth. It's like they're both needed and both operating. But when we're looking at it from the conventional point of view, we call it the storehouse of conventions. It's what it is. And then from the ultimate point of view, we call it this unchanging, pure Buddha nature.
Did you say essence? Are you saying the common characteristic ancestors or form?
Yeah, I mean, essence is a kind of tricky word too, because that's one of the, depending on how we define it, it's, essence is another word for like inherent existence. It's like a truly existent something.
You say common characteristic of ancestors is practice.
The common characteristic. But it's almost like the essence is, doesn't even have any characteristic. It's almost like it's an emptiness, a synonym for emptiness. Maybe we could say the empty function of all Buddhas, the functional emptiness of all ancestors. Makes it more clear. That's a description of Zazen. Right? That's in Dogen's Zazen Shin poem. It's like the workings of these two, like, together. So we're like around
the last two paragraphs.
Okay. When it's impregnated by the habit energy, the vasana. Remember, this term came up a lot. How when we're talking about the storehouse consciousness, we're saying the storehouse is basically created by these habit energies or permeations, perfuming the storehouse. It's like another alternate metaphor for the seeds that are planted. So we could say the seeds or the habit energies.
Yeah, didn't he use that term for projection for a while too?
I think projection
for the turbulence of the ocean.
I think he uses projection for samkalpa. It's one of the five dharmas. Samkalpa. You know, they're all very related terms. But that's how Red Pine's translating. You could say the samkalpa is based on the vasana. The projections. Yeah, almost like the same kind of thing. But you could also say that the habit energies give rise to the projections. But the projections is this particular thing of imagining an external world. And but that does arise due to the habit energy for doing that, the vasanas for doing that. So when it's impregnated by the habit energy of beginningless fabrications, in this case the word is prapancha, it's known as the repository consciousness, alaya vijnana, and gives birth to fundamental ignorance along with seven kinds of consciousness. Now it is, we're talking about here, is the Tathagatagarbha. So this is getting really defining this relationship. When the Tathagatagarbha is impregnated by this habit energy of beginningless fabrications, now we call it, now it's known as the Tathagatagarbha. As the Alaya Vijnana. And it gives birth to fundamental ignorance along with the seven other consciousnesses. Alaya Vijnana is the eighth. So it's like the ocean whose waves rise without cease. So that's kind of like the turbulence metaphor. The Tathagatagarbha. Well, it's harder to know here. If it now is referring to the Tathagatagarbha, it's like the ocean whose waves of Alaya arise, or whether the ocean is like the Alaya Vijnana, whose waves of activity arise and cease.
The ocean contains all possibilities for waves.
Mm-hmm.
It can generate any kind of waves.
But here we could see the ocean as either the Tathagatagarbha and the waves are the Alaya Vijnana, or we could see it as the Alaya Vijnana is the ocean and the waves are like the seeds, yeah, and all the stuff that we're experiencing is like the waves. So either way it works. Both are like oceans. Classically, Alaya Vijnana is said to be like an ocean. That metaphor is used elsewhere. But this is like really looking at how the Tathagatagarbha is the cause of all this good and bad stuff of Alaya, and how that works is when the Tathagatagarbha, this pure Buddha nature, is impregnated by these dualistic, deluded habit energies, it's known as Alaya Vijnana. Now the water is known as ice. It's the same nature as water, but now we call it ice. Alaya Vijnana is the same nature as Tathagatagarbha, now we call it Alaya. It transcends the misconception of impermanence or the conceit of a self and is essentially pure and clear. Seems to be referring to Tathagatagarbha. The seven kinds of thoughts of the remaining forms of consciousness, the will, the manas, conceptual consciousness, mano vijnana, and the other seven consciousnesses, arise and cease as the result of mistakenly projecting and grasping external appearances. Abhuta parikalpa. So that's, yeah, projecting is parikalpa. And abhuta means like false or mistaken. Because people are attached to the names and appearances. So we have those two words. Remember, two of the five dharmas are nama and nimitta, name and appearance, of all kinds of shapes. They are unaware that such forms and characteristics are the perceptions of their own minds. So now we're just weaving together these earlier themes of the sutra. Remember that all the perception, all the these forms that appear are actually perceptions of mind. Mind is another synonym for alaya.
Is that thirsty? Is that that same
drishya? I think this is more like related to, I think related to view, probably drishti. Thirst is also craving, is how do you say that? Yeah, trishna with a T is. It's a different word here. I think this is like more about perception and seeing. the forms and characteristics are the perceptions of their own mind. Sva citta drishya, like self's mind, own mind views or perceptions. And that bliss or suffering do not lead to liberation, moksha. So, bliss or suffering in the way that we think of them don't lead to liberation. Liberation is free from not only suffering, but also free from our ideas of bliss. As they become enveloped by names and appearances, their desires arise and create more desires, each becoming the cause or condition of the next. Only if their senses stopped functioning and the remaining projections of their minds no longer arose, and they did not distinguish bliss or suffering, would they enter the samadhi of cessation of sensation and perception, Nirodha Samapatti, in the fourth dhyana, heaven. So it's going into this whole path based on earlier Abhidharma teachings and so on, that going beyond all dualistic constructs, basically, the cessation, when all of these, all eight consciousnesses stop operating, and then there's just Tathagata Garbha. However, in their cultivation of the truths of liberation, the Four Noble Truths, they give rise to the concept of liberation and fail to transcend or transform paravritti, what is called the repository consciousness of the Tathagata Garbha. So I think the key term here is they give rise to the concept of liberation. And any concepts they have about any of this fail to transform, and that's that Yogacara, important Yogacara term that we use it for transformation of the basis. Paravritti, ashraya, paravritti is transformation of the basis. So transcending or going beyond the repository consciousness, the alaya vijnana of the Tathagata Garbha. So here they're not really, here it sounds like they're playing with, it's the storehouse of Buddha nature. It's the ice of the ocean. They fail to melt the ice of the ocean. They fail to calm the turbulence of the ocean and fully manifest Buddhahood.
Mm-hmm. What's failing?
What is it here? They when they cultivate the Four Noble Truths, which is pretty good, right?
Yes.
These bodhisattvas, they give rise to the concept of liberation. They get like the third and fourth truths. They're like, yeah, it's freedom like this. And therefore, since they have this, even though it's very good to practice the Four Noble Truths, any concept of cessation, like, or liberation, or the Eightfold Path that leads to it, in the end, that concept will ensure these bodhisattvas failing to transform the Tathagata Garbha, because the Tathagata Garbha is based on concepts. And to melt that completely and just be the free-flowing Tathagata Garbha that's free from concepts.
Does the bodhisattva kind of I mean, if they're going to come back and they're going to teach and participate in the suffering, they have to bear it with the people they're teaching, I mean, at the same time. They,
yeah.
Or can they be completely removed and still teach?
Yeah, well, the classical model for this bodhisattva path is that when bodhisattvas, I mean, this is kind of like the classical Indian model, right? It's like there's these 10 bodhisattva stages, and that when bodhisattvas get to the point of being able to, like, consciously come back to help beings, as opposed to being driven by their karma to come back deluded into the world and just wallow around in the suffering of the world, they're and that's why we say bodhisattvas are reborn, but not as totally deluded beings that are reborn due to the power of their twisted karma. They're reborn due to their vow to save beings. So they're like, but they're not fully realized Buddhas that don't come back. I mean, that's the Bodhisattva story, right? They get close. They get really close to Buddhahood where they're not going to come back. But then they're like, so they're working with these appearances. This would be my understanding, is that they're like, they still experience the appearances of the world, but they really don't believe in them. So therefore they can play in the world of appearances and come back and be so-called born. Being born is an appearance. They can do that appearance and then help beings who really do believe the appearances are not just appearances, but they think that they're real, and they can help like that. Does that make sense? It's an interesting story, huh? That there's like this, they're like, we could, you know, go a little bit more and just release the appearances completely, where there's nothing even appearing, and then just like become a Buddha, which also has great benefit. It sounds almost like from this Bodhisattva story that like, well, Buddhas aren't so helpful. They just like are blissing out in like the non-duality of the universe. But actually, Buddhas teach too. It's just that some Bodhisattvas choose to remain Bodhisattvas and like where they more like they can appear as people and more, it's more ordinary path, right? Still maybe kind of exalted from this Indian perspective. They're like, because they see through all the delusions. But then they could also like, well, let's go all the way and be Buddha. But then Buddhas can also manifest a nirmanakaya, a transformation body that's not really like a sentient being. Like Bodhisattvas are still highly evolved sentient beings, but Buddhas would be like, they come back, they can appear, but no longer as sentient beings, and they can appear as like rocks and trees and stuff, whatever would help beings. So you could say, well, if they have the power to become a Buddha, why not do that? Because they do. The vow is to Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So how would I stop short as a Bodhisattva? if I had the choice, and maybe that's what it comes down to, is like, we don't really have the choice. That you know, at this Bodhisattva stages, there's a certain level, and it's like the lifespan's going to end, and you're not a Buddha yet, but you're a Bodhisattva, so you can. Well, we're still going in the direction of Buddhahood, where we can help even more. But let's come back as a Bodhisattva. And maybe some beings were like, no, I really just my particular tendency is like, I don't want to completely do the Buddha thing. I just feel like really drawn to like be more ordinary, like a Bodhisattva. I just like, we don't need, there's enough other Buddhas doing Buddha work. And, you know.
Well, I think my vow is Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it, to become Buddha's way, and not making a vow to become a Buddha, just the Buddha's way, first of all. But also, as you're talking, I'm thinking.
I don't know if that's really different.
Along these lines. I don't know. But for me, I get too wigged out by don't look upon it as just trying to be a function rather than a. Mm-hmm. But as you're talking here, because you mentioned karma, twisted karma, and other things, the Alaya Vijnana that we discussed earlier, through the Sambhinirmo. Sutra has certain particularity about it because it contains our karmic tendencies.
Yeah.
Just to make the model kind of transportable, it seems like the Tathagatagarbha is the Alaya of all Alayas. Like, the ocean is the condition of the possibility of all waves. And our Alaya Vijnana is like a wave in the ocean. And it goes away. And the ocean is the possibility of all possible waves. So Tathagatagarbha, can we conceive of it as the Alaya of all Alayas, the repository of all possible things? All possible karmas?
I don't know if I would call it, though, the alaya of all, if we're saying that that's like this repository consciousness, especially if we're saying alaya vijnana, because of, remember, vijnana is by nature, or that the definition of vijnana is dualistic consciousness, and alaya vijnana is a dualistic consciousness, and Tathagatagarbha is not. So we might call it, and sometimes some Tibetan traditions actually do call Tathagatagarbha alaya, but not alaya vijnana, or the, either just a plain old alaya, like the storehouse, or alaya jnana is also sometimes used. I think not in the sutras, but more in commentaries. So I think that's maybe a key thing. I think we can't really call it Tathagatagarbha alaya vijnana, because vi means divided.
It's the alaya, it's the storehouse of all possible alaya vijnanas.
Yeah, I mean, we could say that.
Okay, then that sense. Like,
it's the alaya of all alaya vijnanas.
Yeah,
or the alaya of all vijnanas. Yeah, the storehouse. I mean, it's interesting that this word, we have this word storehouse, and then we have this word, which is alaya, and then we have this word garbha, that means like heart, but it can also mean like womb, or
embryo,
which is like a storehouse also, right?
Well, the reason I find that helpful, if I can conceive of that, is because if a bodhisattva has so transformed the basis, there's like a few little pinnacles left, like, I'm not going to give up appearances. It's almost right there. It's almost part of alaya, Buddha nature. But it's not inconceivable at this point that a bodhisattva can say, I am this close, I know I'm this close, and I'm not going to give up my manifesting in the world for the sake of all beings. At any moment, we could say, I changed my mind. It's going to flop into it. It's not like there's Buddhas, in the League of Buddhas and the League of Bodhisattvas, they have a World Series. I think it helps me to think of alaya, the storehouse, and Tathagatagarbha as a storehouse of all storehouses. That helps me.
Yeah, I mean, there is a different definition of a Buddha and a Bodhisattva, though, right?
Oh, I agree that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Buddha is not holding on to anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's how we could maybe say it. Bodhisattvas are slightly, I mean, these advanced bodhisattvas are very slightly holding on to appearances, basically. And there's, you could say at the higher level, bodhisattvas really don't believe the appearances, but they're choosing to like manifest them. They're choosing like, let's just like keep giving rise to this room and these other beings.
It's like they're maintaining a conversation between Buddhists and sentient beings.
Mm.
They're like moderating conversation.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, kind of like that. I was just thinking that, alaya and garbha are, just recalling that in the Chinese, they actually use the same character.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Zhou, which means like of Jizo, the storehouse, or Shobogenzo, the treasury or storehouse. It also means womb in Japanese and treasury and storehouse. Let's skip these next, let's skip down a little bit and to therefore Mahamati, bodhisattvas who seek the highest goal, do you see that place? Should purify what are called the Tathagatagarbha and the repository consciousness. Mahamati, if there were nothing called the repository consciousness, the Tathagatagarbha, now I put in here, then the external world of things would neither arise nor cease. Now, Red Pine doesn't do it that way. He just says the Tathagatagarbha would neither arise nor cease if there were nothing called the repository consciousness. That didn't make sense to me. That's kind of saying that the alaya comes first and that the Tathagatagarbha actually doesn't arise and cease. But D.T. Suzuki basically interprets it like this. And this, to me, this makes sense, that if there were nothing called the alaya vijnana, then the Tathagatagarbha, if there were nothing called the alaya vijnana, in parentheses, the Tathagatagarbha, you know, whose true nature is it's Tathagatagarbha, then the external world of things would neither arise nor cease. In other words, you need the alaya for to have arising and ceasing, because in Tathagatagarbha, purified of alaya vijnana, there's no arising and ceasing. All of that. But sages and fools alike experience arising and cessation, Mahamati. Therefore, practitioners who cultivate the personal realization of Buddha knowledge dwell in the bliss of whatever is present and do not abandon their practice. Mahamati, although this repository consciousness of the Tathagatagarbha, so in Sanskrit it is Tathagatagarbha Alaya Vijnana, seen by the minds of Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas, is essentially pure. Although it's essentially pure, because it's obscured by the dust of sensation, which is actually klesha here, which is like defilements or afflictions, it appears impure, but not to Tathagatas. To Tathagatas, Mahamati, the realm that appears before them is like an amala fruit in the palm of their hand. So, some kind of like fruit that they can see Tathagatagarbha directly, Buddhas. But this is a really nice section here. I thought that that explaining what we've been talking about, also that this Tathagatagarbha, even though it's essentially pure, when it's defiled, obscured by the kleshas, it appears impure. So that's just an appearance. But Tathagatas don't see any of this as impure or dualistic. And then he goes on to say, Mahamati, I've used my spiritual power to support Queen Srimala and other bodhisattvas of deep wisdom to explain the meaning of what are called the repository consciousness and the Tathagatagarbha. So then he talks about Queen Srimala teaching the... Down near the, at the bottom of that paragraph, the repository consciousness of the Tathagatagarbha is something only Buddhas and those wisest of bodhisattvas who rely on meaning understand. Therefore, you and the other bodhisattvas should diligently reflect on the repository consciousness of the Tathagatagarbha. Don't simply think that hearing about this is enough. You have to reflect on it.
Also, he's asked, on one level, he's saying, therefore, you and other bodhisattvas should reflect on alaya, which we've been doing for months in this class.
Yeah.
But he's making it bigger, making the way that Janya is.
Yeah.
He's all know that this alaya is, that this alaya vijnana that you've been studying is in a bigger context.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very much a part of.
Yeah, and it's perfectly pure in its nature. So it's a wonderful way to end this long Yogacara study, is to see that all this delusion that we've been studying is really, in its nature, perfectly pure and undefiled, and can't be any other way. It just appears that way. So
we can also observe something else here, I think, with this model. That if you see ourselves as waves, our own alaya vijnana as a wave of karmic tendencies, and the wave goes away, the next another wave that comes up that contains some of those karmic tendencies is a kind of rebirth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is not the same as a replication of a person.
Yeah. There's not really a person.
Really
a person is a conceptual construct.
The tendencies are there to be purified.
To be worked with and practiced with endlessly. So the Srimala Devi Sutra is another great and not so long sutra about, it's a Tathagatagarbha Buddha Nature Sutra that you can read. And I just wanted to mention, since he brings her up as, she's one of our women ancestors too, right? Srimala Devi. She says about the Tathagatagarbha in that sutra, the Tathagatagarbha is the Dharmakaya when not free from the storehouse of defilement. or the Dharmakaya, when it's not free from the storehouse of defilement, which is kind of like Alaya Vijnana, is called the Tathagata Garbha, which we've been saying that. She defines quite clearly. And then there's this nice point in the sutra where she says, the Tathagata Garbha is empty of the storehouse of defilement. In other words, the storehouse of defilement doesn't really harm the Tathagata Garbha in any way. It doesn't, we say that we're talking about it's contained in it, but ultimately speaking, those delusions don't truly exist in Tathagata Garbha. Therefore, that's one way we say Tathagata Garbha is empty. It's empty of true defilements. But also the Tathagata Garbha is not empty. It's not empty of the inconceivable Buddha dharmas and Buddha qualities. So I thought that's a nice little thing about it. The Tathagata Garbha is empty of all these delusions that we think are real, but it's not empty of like Buddha wisdom and Buddha compassion and light. No, it's not. That's in the Srimala Devi Sutra. Empty and yet not empty. Empty of a certain thing, but not empty of another thing. And then just lastly here, the Buddha then repeated the meaning of this in verse. Deep is the Tathagata Garbha with seven kinds of consciousness, the two kinds of grasping, like grasping the self and objects, or subject and object, that arise are avoided by the wise. The mind, or alaya, we could say, is like a reflected image, the result of habit energy without beginning. For those who see what is real, whatever is seen isn't seen. Strictly speaking, ultimately, whatever is seen isn't really seen in emptiness. Like fools who see me point to the moon, look at my finger and not at the moon. Those who cling to names don't see this truth of mine. So there's the great classic metaphor, the finger pointing at the moon, which maybe originates in the sutra, I'm not sure. All of these weeks of classes pointing at the moon, those who try to get it through these words and names don't see the direct truth of the moon. The mind, citta or alaya, is the hero in a play, or D.T. Suzuki says a dancer. The will, that seventh consciousness, manas, is the hero's confidant, or D.T. Suzuki says a jester. Just somebody kind of helping out the main dancer. Kind of fooling around. It's kind of nice, the jester. Because that's the self one. The seventh is the self. It's kind of like there's the dancers on the play and then the jester comes in, look at you guys, and trips them and stuff like that. And then the five forms of consciousness are the cast in the play, and projections are the audience. Or D.T. Suzuki says the projections are the stage. So like this whole play going on, and then what we see is the stuff out there is like the stage, the world basically is our stage in which all, yeah, it's kind of a nice little metaphor about the seven consciousnesses that are all playing out this play, this ridiculous play, this beautiful play, this tragic play, this comedy. In the ocean of Buddha nature. And whether we ever think about this stuff again, this is one story of what's happening right now and for the rest of our life. And may it be helpful. And may just playing, dancing with these teachings help us and help us to help all beings melt the ice of what we believe to be true, so we can swim freely and all beings can swim freely in the vast ocean of eternal brightness. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.